welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 6th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Okay, good evening. My name is Foster Hirsch. I am a film historian and a longtime friend of the Film Forum. I have been asked, and it is my pleasure to host this very special event tonight. This film opened at the Little Carnegie 50 years ago. I was there. I was there the day after Bosley Crowther gave this film a devastatingly negative review. And that effect killed this film in America. The film's hardly been seen since. It's been almost impossible to see it for decades. And tonight, you're going to be seeing it. Really special, restored, it's lustrous, it's the film Orson Welles called his very favorite, and it is a particular honor to introduce the star of the film, who's come all the way from England to be with us here tonight, a distinguished actor whom Orson Welles had great faith in, and you'll see why. His performance in the film is stunning. Please welcome Mr. Keith Baxter.
He's got one too.
This one's fine. I'm not quite sure how to work this. That's working. First of all, it's a tremendous privilege to introduce this film, and I thank Film Forum for inviting me to be here to pay tribute to Orson. And I'm not going to deliver a long introduction because the film speaks for itself. But I thought I'd just tell you how it began, how the adventure started, leading up to the first shot of the first day when Sir John Gielgud said, "How now, my Lord of Worcester?" And for me, the adventure started when I was washing dishes in a restaurant at the top of the Haymarket. And one of the other waiters, also out of work actor, said that Orson Welles was in town and he was seeing actors and actresses for a production based on the plays of Shakespeare, the Henry IV histories, but featuring himself as Falstaff. And that day that he'd seen women, and the next day he was going to see men. And he gave me a telephone number, and I was told to be at the New Theatre at 10 o'clock the next day. And I got there at 10 o'clock, and I finally got on stage at 3 o'clock. And I realized why, because Welles had this wonderful attitude towards actors. He never stopped anybody doing their speeches. So the auditions went on a long time. He was a big star then. He just done The Third Man, and we were all much in awe of him. And when I got on stage, he said, "My name is Orson Welles. What are you going to do for me?" So I told him what I was going to do for him, and I did it. And he said, "Will you play Prince Hal?" That was kind of devastating. I couldn't quite believe it. But anyway, a few weeks later, the message came through. We were going to start rehearsing in Tottenham Court Road in the Young Women's Christian Association rooms upstairs behind Tottenham Court Road. He wasn't there for the first 3 weeks. He was in Paris cutting the trial. But eventually, we opened in Ireland. It would look like being a wonderful gig. We were going to open in Belfast for 3 weeks, and then in Dublin for 4 weeks, and then we were going to go to Athens and Amsterdam and Rome and Paris and London. Well, we never got beyond Ireland because it was a disaster, and they hated it. And luckily, Orson was by himself because his wife, whom he adored, was still in Rome and his little daughter, so he was alone, and he liked me. And he was lonely, and he said, "What are you doing after the show?" I never had anything to do. So I ate with him almost every night, and he talked about Roosevelt and Churchill. And, of course, he was a wonderful talker, and I was a willing disciple. And then we moved to Dublin, and his wife arrived, and his little daughter. And we played to half-empty houses. And sometimes he cancelled the whole performance and sent all the actors off to the Guinness Brewing Factory. But he'd never let me go because he said, I'm going to do Orson Welles Meets the Irish and have it filmed. And I had to stand at the back of the stalls because he did a chunk of Moby Dick and I had to yell out, ahoy there, the Pequod, and then duck as every turn around. But I loved him. And the last night in Dublin was very sad, obviously. And his great friend, the American actress Geraldine Fitzgerald, whom he had acted with at the Mercury years ago, was living in Dublin, and she gave a wonderful farewell lunch on the Sunday before the boat left. And I was getting increasingly sad, and as we went to the boat, Orson had a terrific row, and when he was in a rage, it was Titanic, and you fled. But he had a row with this young actress, I don't know what, but he went below to his cabin and slammed the door, and I went up on the deck. I was feeling pretty moody. I'm Welsh, and Sir John Gielgud says all the Welsh carry around with them a private cloud of melancholy. But anyway, I was feeling awful. I thought, I'm going back home. I'm going to be washing dishes. I'm going to be on the dole. And then I smelt a cigar. And about a few feet away, Orson was leaning over the rail. And he said, you'll get over this. It's not important. It was an experiment that hasn't worked. And he said, in 1940, in the Academy Awards, every time they mentioned a nomination for Citizen Kane, the audience booed. He said, I've got over that. And he said, this hasn't worked because it was wrong. He said, I realize it was impossible to reduce these two wonderful plays into one short evening. And what it really is a love story. And it's a love story of a boy who's torn between two father figures, one whom he reveres but cannot love, a king who has blood on his hands, and the other a scoundrel and a wonderfully warm-hearted man whom he loves but cannot respect. That's the story, Orson said, and I'll make it one day, and it'll work as a film, and I'll never make it unless I ask you to play Prince Hal again. And he meant it. You know, in our world, people make promises which they don't often mean. Anyway, the doors opened for me as a result of having played with Prince Hal. I came to Broadway for the first time to play the king in A Man for All Seasons. And I did other plays. And then in the summer, late summer of 1964, I had a letter saying, dearest boy, why don't we go ahead with our pint-sized version of Chimes? There probably won't be a penny in it for any of us, but will be worthwhile and, I think, fun. So I flew to Madrid in early October, and I got a taxi up to his apartment. And when I arrived, I could smell the cigar smoke. That was always an indication of Orson's presence. And I was terribly happy, you can imagine. And I went up in the elevator. And his secretary, Mrs. Rogers, who had been in Ireland and was with him really until he died, she opened the doors of the elevator and pulled me into the kitchen and said, the film's cancelled, but I've got you on a flight back to London this evening. And then I heard this great shout of laughter. And Orson came in, followed by the young Spanish producer, and said, we're rolling. And he introduced me to the producers, and one of them said, ah, welcome, Dr. Livesey, welcome. And I was a bit surprised by that. So they left, and Orson said, come on, we'll have lunch. Paula's cooked this wonderful lunch. And I said, what was all that about Dr. Livesey? He said, well, I'm making Treasure Island as well. That's how I got the money. And you're going to be Dr. Livesey? I said, what is Sir John going to play? He said, oh, he'll be the squire. I said, does he know? He said, no, I don't think we ought to tell him. So the next day I had to go to Corneco, the costumio, it's for fittings for some royal clothes. And there was this very, very pretty 15-year-old boy in a treacorn hat who was obviously going to be playing Jim and in Treasure Island. He said, oh, he said, are you going to be in my film? And I said, well, I suppose so. I never saw him again. And the next day, Orson said, we've got to get up very early. I'll collect you at the hotel. And we drove all across Spain with Mrs. Rogers and a chauffeur. And there weren't great autostrada in those days. The traffic was heavy-ish, but not really heavy. And it was incredible to be with him because he loved Spain. And we drove through La Mancha and we stopped in Zaragoza. And eventually you arrived at Alicante, where there was a tiny little cove with the ship that had been used in Billy Budd. And there were the producers and champagne, and they all greeted Orson with great acclaim. And then he said, are we ready? And he said, action! And the mainsail of the ship, the Hispaniola, which had been used in Billy Budd, came tumbling down, and Orson said, cut! And everybody had a glass of champagne, and he said, let's go. I never saw that boat ever again. He had arranged the money for the film by saying he would shoot Treasure Island at the same time. And he said, I'll shoot it on location. I mean, the island can be Ibiza, and we've got the ship from Billy Budd, and all I need is a tavern. And by the way, if we build a tavern, I'm going to shoot all of Chimes at Midnight on location, and that tavern can be the tavern for Chimes at Midnight. Well, the producers swallowed it. And that's how he got the money. And after he'd said cut, we drove to a little inn, a little cove. It probably looks like Miami Beach now, called Calpe. And there was a small hotel, and we ate dinner out of doors. And he, for the only time, spoke about Chimes at Midnight. He wanted to make it clear to an audience that it was not Shakespeare's England, but it was 200 years before. As people in Broadway now are going to see Hamilton, it's quite clear, and they realize that it's 200 years ago. But a lot of people seeing, because it's in costume and it's in iambic pentameters, tended to think that it's a contemporary world. And Orson was very determined that the audience should know that it was 200 years, a different England, an England of castles, of forests, of meadows. And everything had changed by the time Shakespeare wrote the play. The dynasty had changed. The Plantagenets, who had ruled England for 400 years, we had a new dynasty, the Tudors. Everything was different. War had changed, gunpowder. So the idea of the romance of the war and that battles could be solved by a duel was entirely of its time, which had disappeared by the time Shakespeare was writing the plays. And that's why the audience, when you see the film, Hotspur wears silver armor. He's a very romantic figure, and he's dressed in this silver armor where the king's troops and Prince Hal's troops are all in black. And Orson wanted to make that clear, that this, the death of Hotspur was the death of chivalry. And that's something he made. And then he said, I want to, it sounds pretentious the way I say it, but he said, I want to call down the corridors of time with this film. So then we started. We drove up to Barcelona to film the royal scenes. And when we arrived in Barcelona, the producer's assistant said, we can't shoot here. We can't shoot because the hotel isn't winterized. And Orson said, but Sir John arrives tomorrow. He said, well, we can't. We've got nothing to put him in. There's no armor. We can't. And Orson said, doesn't matter. I've got to shoot on him. Back to Madrid. So he flew back to Madrid. I drove back with Mrs. Rogers. And the next day, there were no hotels in Madrid. And Paola, Orson's wife, had arranged two bedrooms in this apartment building that Orson had taken to cut the film. A totally empty apartment, but two bedrooms gorgeously furnished for myself and Norman Rodway. And Sir John was due to arrive the next day. So Orson said, you've got to go and meet him. And what's he going to wear? He said, I don't know, let him choose something. And so I went to the airport to meet Sir John, and he was accompanied by his partner, a Hungarian, of whom Orson said, if you have a Hungarian for a lover, you never need an enemy. And the man's name was Martin Hensler, and he was in a vile temper. I have stinking cold. I don't know why we come here. And they were slightly alarmed that there was no hotel. So I took them to El Escorial, which was 50 miles out of Madrid, and there was a very nice hotel. And I said, well, we're starting shooting tomorrow. And John said, oh, what will I wear? Have I got the crown? I said, well, no, the crown is still in London. I didn't want him to know that everything was in a state of chaos. So I went back to home, and there was Orson and his wife and Norman Rodway, who had arrived. And he said, we have to find something for you to wear tomorrow for the, I said, well, what? He said, well, it'll be underdress armor. I said, what's that? He said, I don't know. And they brought in, a boy brought in a big wicker basket from the Samuel Bronson Studios, and we were all drinking gin and tonics, and they sat around, and I undressed in my jockstrap, and this is what I wore, a pair of knitted chainmail trousers and a tunic worn by one of Charlton Heston's servants in El Cid, and on top of that I wore a wonderful suede waistcoat worn by Jane Mansfield in The Sheriff of Fractured Jaw. And then we went to bed, and Orson said, you've got to bring John to the shooting tomorrow for the first day shooting. And he said, go dress like that, because you'll be in the shots later. So I did. I went over the next morning very early, and Orson was getting in a car to go to the location. And he said, I'm so frightened. I said, why? He said, well, John is the greatest actor in the world, you know, the greatest Shakespearean actor in the world. And I hope he doesn't feel that I'm just an old trickster. And I said, no, I'm sure he won't. Anyway, I went to the hotel where Martin was still in a terrible temper. The electricity, she don't work. The elevator, she don't work. And what am I going to wear? So John said, well, you look rather dandy, Keith, he said. He said, what am I going to wear? And at that moment, a boy from the costume department brought in a big dust sheet with a knot in it. It was like a scene from a farce. And John opened it and looked with dismay. I don't know if you've ever seen a pair of tights that have been slung in a corner for ages. And he was very fastidious, Sir John. He just picked up these tights and looked at them and said, shall I get Spanish crabs, do you think? But Martin said, oh, why don't we go home? He said, don't be silly. We're here now. And he said, oh, it's such fun dressing up. And he went into the other room and pulled on a pair of tights and said, shall I have the crown? I said, no, 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 the crown isn't here, John. He said, well, maybe I can have a big brooch or something. I said, I'm sure you can have a big brooch. And out he came, looking kind of marvelous. And he said, oh, I do love acting and dressing up. It's such fun being an actor. And then they said, it's time to go to the location. So we went to the location, and suddenly on top of the hill, you could see all these medieval tents and the banners flying. And John said, oh, doesn't it look wonderful, Martin? He was the most enthusiastic man, Gielgud, and everybody in the profession. You'll never hear anybody tell a story about Gielgud that isn't funny and affectionate. Anyway, we arrived at this huge field, which had been a cornfield, which had just been cut. And Orson saw him at the top and shouted, hello, John. And John said, oh, I'm standing in the corn. I feel just like Ruth in the Alien Corn. And somebody said, would you like a donkey, Sir John? He said, no, they bite. I hate them. So he climbed up to meet Orson, and they embraced. And Orson said, look, there's a stone here. That's all you have to do. Just step into the stone and say, how now, my lord of Worcester? And John said, well, what about makeup? And Orson said, oh, we don't wear makeup. Nobody's wearing makeup. And John said, well, a wig. What about a wig? And he said, no, 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 we're not wearing wigs. He said, but I'm going bald. I'm losing all my hair. And Orson said, well, maybe Henry IV was bald and losing all his hair. And John said, but look at Keith's. His hair is blowing everywhere. What will it look like? And Orson said, it will look real, John. And then he said, how now, my lord at Worcester? And the film started. I'm going to skip right to the end now, because you'll see the film and you'll remember that. But at the end of the film, we ran out of money. And everybody had left. Sir John was on Broadway in a play by Edward Albee. Jean Moreau was in Mexico shooting a film with Brigitte Bardot. Margaret Rutherford. Everybody had gone except me. And they had no money. They'd run out of money. And the producer said, I'm sorry, Senor Baxter, I can pay you a per diem, but you will get your main money when I have money. So Orson said, go to Morocco. You'll have a lot of fun in Morocco, as long as you go to American Express twice a week and see if there's a message. And eventually there was one just saying, got the money, come back. And I went back, and all I had to do was the final scene that Prince Hal has with Falstaff. And we found a little church and arrived there, and Orson was made up, which is not usual when you're shooting on me first. He said, we'll shoot Mr. Baxter first. And usually then he waits for the reverses. But he was dressed and made up. And he said, we shoot, well, I want a low shot of Mr. Baxter looking up, so it'll be sort of iconic. And then close-up. The rest will be all in close-up. So while they were lighting it, we went and sat in a corner. And I was leaving the very next day. And we sat, and Orson said, well, this is time to say goodbye, isn't it? And he meant goodbye in the film between Falstaff and Prince Hal, and goodbye between Orson and I. And it was been a long time of friendship. And he said, it's a long time since Belfast, isn't it? And I said, yes, it is. He said, well, just do the speech. You'll do it beautifully. He said, you may find in the middle of the speech that you're choking up and perhaps you'll feel like crying. And he said, that's fine. I wouldn't. But he said, you do it your way. He said, the thing about tears is that audience hate it to see a man crying. But if they see you wanting to cry but not allowing yourself to cry, that will be very moving. So that's the way we did it. And that night I had dinner with his wife and his daughter, and then we said goodbye. I hope you enjoy the film.
Ladies and gentlemen, after the film, Mr. Baxter will be back for a Q&A session. And we want to thank Criterion for restoring the film, and we want to thank Janus Films for making this very special occasion possible. The re-release of this great film, Chimes at Midnight. Please welcome King Henry V, otherwise known as that wonderful actor, Keith Baxter. Have much time, but we want to ask you a few questions. I'll ask one or two and then open it to the House. I do want to ask you one or two questions. One, we can't help but notice the soundtrack. I'm assuming all the dialogue was dubbed in a studio after it was shot. Yes. Was there no direct sound recording in this production
at all?
None.
No, well, the tavern was built in the the tavern was sort of built in the meat market of Madrid. So it was impossible to have good sound there. And everything else was on location. And that old castle, which I went back to earlier this year, it's now been repaired and is beautiful. It's an hotel now. But it was very cold there. And the wonderful thing about... Well, it's very moving seeing this film, very moving for me, because I was not much more than a boy, and Orson put his faith in me. But there was so much laughter, you know, when we made it. Orson did everything. He loved actors. So in just before the king was dying, those royal scenes, it was so cold late at night, And Orson had a wind-up gramophone with Lena Horne singing Stormy Weather between the breaks. And he came up, we were setting up the death of Sir John, and everybody in the English theatre adored Gielgud. He was not a vain man at all, but people adored him, not just because of the greatness of his talent, but he was such fun to be with. I mean, people admire, of course, Laurence Olivier, but when actors get together, they don't tell funny stories about Larry, but they're always funny stories about Sir John. And when we were shooting the... there was no glass in the windows. When we were shooting his death scene, and Orson came up and said, "Are you all right, John?" And he said, "Oh, I'm freezing. My thighs are so cold." So he said, "Well, get Sir John a hot water bottle." So when I'm watching the film, and I did find it incredibly moving, I remember that Sir John was given a hot water bottle just before he was dying. And he... And he said to me, "Aren't I the lucky boy?"
Now, I can't help in noticing the film that every camera shot is so brilliantly set up. Obviously, a great eye made the film. Was there a lot of preparation before each shot? Or did Orson Welles come to the set knowing that's where he wanted the camera placed in that scene?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There was very little. We only rehearsed the first tavern scene when he accuses us of stealing his money. That was rehearsed a lot, mainly for the camera, because if you notice in that scene, the camera's moving around, the actors are moving around. Most scenes in film these days, either the camera moves or the actor moves. But that scene, we're all moving, and that we rehearsed all day. But most scenes weren't rehearsed. I mean, Sir John's great speech about how many thousand of my poorest... He just did it. Orson said, "Well, will you stand here, John? The light is coming through these windows and you can see it." And he said, "Oh, yes, I know it very well." So he just did it. And the crew applauded because they'd never heard an actor speak for so long without interruption. But there was no most... When I watch the film now, and of course I find it very moving... Well, I see my youth, of course, and that. But I remember, what I most remember is the laughter. I mean, it's such a moving film, at least I find it a moving film, but what you can't see is the laughter. I mean, the fun. There was great fun, and all those shots you talk about, how beautiful they are, Orson, as a young boy, drew... And he drew a lot of the costumes and things. He had an artist's eye for the composition, and he was thrilled that we weren't going to make it in color. He always said, "Color takes away 25% of an actor's performance." Well, I don't know whether that's true, but certainly most of the great films that I love, like Casablanca, All About Eve, well, you name them, they're in black and white. And I watch this film, and I see... They're like etching sometimes.
The battle scene is a series of master paintings.
Yes.
That's an extraordinary sequence.
Yes, and has been pinched by many others, including Mel Gibson in Braveheart, and who took an awful long time to acknowledge that it was inspirational. But he didn't have a lot of people, you see. He had about 150 riders, I think, for 4 days. And that was shot all in the Casa de Campo, which is like the Central Park of Madrid, but wilder. And by reversing the negative and all those tricks that he could do, it made you feel there were far, far more soldiers. And often they didn't know how... He wanted a big movement, so they would call. He'd call on me and say, "Keith, will you put on a funny hat or some disguise?" And then he'd say, "Follow the king." So I would go. He said, "I want them all to sweep around these cannon." So I would start walking, and then they'd all follow me. And then I was cut out of the actual, once he got the film down. But it was fun. I look at it now.
Were there not a lot of takes for each shot?
You no.
Did it once, basically.
No. I don't know how many there were when he was shooting the battle, but most scenes, I mean, Gielgud's soliloquy about how many thousand of my poorest subjects are now asleep was done in one take. But then he said, we have to do another one because you're going to New York to be in Edward Albee's play. So for security, oh, yes, I can do it again. I can do it 12 times.
did Orson not direct you as an actor? He didn't shape your performance?
No, never. The only time he offered direction was, as I told you before the film, when we were going to do the last speech, which was my last day on the filming, and when he said, you know, you may feel like crying and that doesn't matter, but I wouldn't, he said. That's why he said audiences don't like seeing a man cry. They'll be much more moved if they think you're holding back tears.
And you did. You held back. Yes, you followed him.
Yes, I did. I found it... Well, but because we'd been so many years. I mean, we'd started and met in 1959, and this was 1965 when we finished, and it was a long time and a long journey. And, when somebody really... I use the word carefully, but when somebody loves you, in the purest way, of course, but... A great genius as he was, how could you not be heartbroken when it came to the end of the film, you know?
Do we have some questions for Keith Baxter? Yes, sir.
I don't mean to be too technical because I'm overwhelmed with the beauty of the work you did. You did such a fabulous job, and it's so beautiful that it's preserved in the film as it is. It was as though you were on stage, and it was... absolutely fabulous. And I was moved as well.
Thank you.
And I have a technical question.
Yes.
About the armor. Do you believe that people could actually fight all dressed up in that armor on horses after you've gone through that experience?
Do I believe that people could actually ride on horses in that armor? Well, they did. They did, and in fact, they did in the film. I mean, it was real armor. When it arrived, it was real. It was metal. It was real. But
sir, right behind. Second row.
Did you have favorite scenes? Any particular moments that stand out that you really enjoy seeing again?
Do I have a favorite scene?
Yeah.
Yes, I love the last scene with Orson when I'm tumbling around on the bed with Jeanne, who, of course, was heaven to work with. I mean, she was a big star then. It was right after she'd done Jules et Jim, and she and I got on, well, wonderfully well. And she was taking me to the Prado one day to see the Goyas. And when we came out of the hotel, there were some journalists, and they said, Miss Moreau, why are you doing this part? It's so short. And she just said, Orson Welles asked me. And that's what everybody felt, this wonderful affection for Orson. And what you can't see is how much laughter there was. I mean, we never stopped laughing. Really, it was wonderful. And when the beginning of the film, when we were shooting in that great cathedral, it was still quite warm. So we would have these wonderful lunches out of doors. And John Gielgud was a great raconteur, and Orson was. And we all sat there, and there were three Spanish actors. And it was quite difficult because Fernando Rey's family had fought for the Republicans in the Civil War, and Andrea Macuto and Pepe Neto, they had supported Franco. So, and the war wasn't that, it was still in people's experience. But Sir John and Orson never stopped telling stories and about the theatre or something. And then they would clear the table, and Orson would lie on the table with his cloak over him and fall asleep. And we'd all go off until he and woke up and he'd say, action, and we'd go back to work again.
Sir? Yes?
I just wanted to find out, you have any recollections of Margaret Rutherford?
Well, Margaret was a great actress, extraordinary. And luckily, after the film, I played in The Rivals on stage with Ralph Richardson and Margaret playing Mrs. Malaprop. And she simply was unique, but she was fey in the real sense of the word. She was Faye. I can't explain it any other way. But she was wonderful. And one day we were shooting in the cars at the camp. It was a very, very cold day. And it was early in the morning. And Orson saw her sitting under a hawthorn bush and said, oh, she looks very cold. And he had a big vacuum flask of coffee with Spanish brandy, Fundador. So he said, Dame Margaret looks very cold. Would you go and ask her if she'd like a cup of coffee? So I went over and I said, do you want a cup of coffee, Dame Margaret? She said, oh, I would love it. She had a lot of chins. I said, would you like some brandy? Oh, I'd love some brandy. So I went and got and I gave it to her and I said, Mr. Wells is worried whether you're feeling cold or are you all right or happy? She said, oh, yes, I'm wonderful. She said, working with him is like walking where there's always sunshine. Well, that was a wonderful thing to say. And it sounds affected, but she wasn't affected. And she was a great, great actress, of course, better known in this country for her comic roles in films, but she was extraordinary.
I think the audience should know that the little page is Beatrice Wells.
Oh, yes, the little page.
She's an adorable child and a wonderful actress.
I think she'll be here tomorrow.
Friday. But she's a natural in film.
Well,
she's lovely.
Yes. She's dubbed, of course, she had a little Italian accent from her mother. But we found a Cockney boy in London who dubbed her. Yeah.
But she has a very expressive face.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes. Yes.
I just wanted to know what you tried out with. You told the story where you tried out for Orson Welles and he hired you. And what was the piece that you spoke?
When I auditioned for him?
Yes.
Well, I sat up all night thinking, what bit should I do? A bit of Hamlet? Shall I do a bit of Romeo? And I thought, oh, well, he's probably sick of hearing Shakespeare. And I had done, at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I'd done a piece from a play by Emlyn Williams, who was quite a well-known playwright. And the teacher said, you do that speech wonderfully. You should keep it up your sleeve sometime. So when I was going through my Shakespeare and thinking, what speech? I suddenly thought, I was getting more and more nervous. And I thought, well, I'll do the Emlyn Williams speech. So when Orson said, when I finally got on stage, what are you going to do for me, Mr. Baxter? I said, well, I'm going to do a piece from a play by Emlyn Williams. He said, oh, Emlyn Williams, how wonderful. So I think that partly won him over before I'd started. And at the end, he's actually said, well, I can be conceited enough to say, he came down, he said, it's been a great privilege to listen to you. Will you play Prince Hal?
Oh.
And I'd been washing dishes, so that is something, you know.
It occurs to me, as you're talking about Orson Welles, did you make any connection between him and the character he was playing? Was he connected to Falstaff in any characteristics?
No, I mean, he was big, but he wore padding. No, I think what comes through in the film, which is what he said on the boat coming out of Dublin, it's a love story. It's a love triangle. It's a boy taught between loving his father, whom he respecting his father, but whom he cannot love, and loving this rogue, but whom he can't respect. And he said, that's the story, Keith. It's a love story. And it was a love story in the purest sense of the word. And I feel, watching the film, that without being aware of playing that, one becomes overwhelmed, or at least by the kind of affection that exists between Falstaff and Prince Hal, which was actually what existed between Orson and me and Orson's family. I mean, I sort of was living en famille, really, with his wife, who was a wonderful Italian woman. And I think that illumines the film, although when I don't think I was particularly aware of it. But I found it, I hadn't seen it for some time, and I think it's a wonderful print. I've been looked after in the last couple of days by somebody called Issy Chubb, who's just looked after me and cared about, well, are you comfortable with it? And seeing this film restored in this way is quite wonderful. Last time I saw it, it wasn't nearly as good a print as this, or, and it, that's been very exciting. I think Film Forum is remarkable.
The Criterion Collection. Yes.
But we are in Film Forum.
Yeah.
But Criterion have done it, yes.
But I'm wondering, as you speak, that the strength of your performance opposite Wells grew out exactly of the relationship that he cultivated with you.
Well, inevitably. But it wasn't cultivated. It just grew. I mean, he was a wonderful actor. And he cared about the actors. I mean, he really loved actors. And I think what he liked, and it's the same in Citizen Kane, as having a lot of actors around, he was the sort of captain of the ship. But he always cared about the actors. And I think he thought of himself as an actor rather than a director, in a way. I mean, I saw quite by chance the night before I left, there was a big documentary about him on English television, and a long interview with a man called Michael Parkinson, in which he talked about how he loved being an actor, and he said, I would have given my soul to have played The Godfather, but he said, I wasn't wanted. And it's impossible to think of The Godfather without thinking of Marlon Brando's wonderful performance. But Orson loved actors, and he thought of himself as an actor. He used to say, directing's easy. You get a wonderful, of course it's rubbish, but you just get a wonderful lighting cameraman and a wonderful designer, and you know, just you move the camera around, and that's it. But he respected actors. I mean, it was very touching how he deferred to Sir John constantly. I mean, well, John didn't realize that, but and after lunch, you know, after we had these wonderful lunches and Orson would fall asleep, the big thing, because we were filming on top of the mountain and there were no loos, and the big thing was how to go, you know, we were all wearing tights and things. And Sir John never took off his crown. And we were sitting, and there was a boy who was going to play Richard II, but it was cut from the film, Oscar Pellissier. And we were lying in the long grass, and he gave me, he gave me a joint. And I didn't have a scene. And then Sir John came back, and he said, oh, I found a wonderful place to be all by myself. And there were four nuns squatting there. So there was a lot of hilarity, I can tell you.
Okay, I'm watching the film. It's so brilliantly edited, but it's very quickly edited. Did you do scenes in short spurts, or were they long scenes that then were edited?
Oh, well, the tavern scene was a long scene. But Orson thought audiences got bored very quickly, and he cut like a machine gun.
He really did.
I mean, I think that's one of the staggering things about the battle. It's so fast. If you notice, Hotspur is always on the move, and the wonderful robbery in the forest, which is like a cathedral with the falling, it's so fast. He believed that audiences got bored very quickly, and the one thing to not allow them to get bored was to be fast.
So but almost all the speeches are cut rapidly. A few, the camera just sits there. John Gielgud's speech, and then Margaret, yes, Rutherford's at the end.
Yes.
The camera doesn't move. But mostly the rest of the speeches are cut pretty,
yes, but
pretty
quickly. When you have a long speech like that, or when my speech at the end, yes, it cuts occasionally to Orson listening. What is there to do except to have the speech? And there one, I mean, I think he makes Shakespeare so accessible. I think it's, unless you really have an aversion to Shakespeare, I think the text is played brilliantly. And the only people ask me about what direction, and I can't think of any direction except what I told you earlier on when he said, if you want to cry, that's fine. But my advice is not, because audiences don't like watching a man cry, but they'll be moved if they think you want to cry, but you don't. So, I mean, that was the only kind of direction that he gave one about acting. No, he didn't. People can't believe when I say, well, I can't remember any positive acting direction he gave, except that thing about the last speech.
But he cast knowing the part was in you.
Well, I'd done it on stage, and he liked me very much, and we'd hung out a lot in Belfast together because his wife hadn't arrived, and his daughter, and he was lonely. And that was... So we became friends that way.
Another question from House?
One more question. Let it be a good one.
Did you ever see Orson again after the movie ended?
I saw him. Yes, and this is a good way to end, really. I saw him on New Year's Eve in 1972. I'd had a great success on Broadway with a play called Sleuth, a thriller. And I'd come back to England, and Paola rang me up and said, Orson's here, and Beatrice, come over. It was New Year's Eve, so I went. I went, and actually with a great friend of mine who was a wonderful comic writer called Bert Shevelov, who had written A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And we had a wonderful evening. And that was really the last time, and except that I was in Los Angeles. I've never really known Los Angeles. I've never had... I don't mean this in any grand way. I've never really... Los Angeles has nothing to offer me. I never... Well, I like the theater. And I knew that really there was nothing for me. But I had done... I just and Anthony and Cleopatra with Maggie Smith. And there was a party in New York. And Jack Lord was there. And he was very impressed that I'd done Mark Antony. And he'd always wanted to play. So he said, would you ever think of... coming to do a Hawaii 5-0. I said, I would love to do a Hawaii 5-0. So I went to Hawaii and did a Hawaii 5-0, and I wondered why I'd been asked so quickly, and it turned out that I was replacing Sammy Davis Jr. I was playing a crooked revivalist minister, and it had been written for Sammy Davis Jr., but Sammy Davis Jr. had asked for a different hotel. He wanted to bring his secretary, a whole, and in the end, Jack Lord said, oh, well, sod that, I've just met somebody. And so I went to Hawaii. And on the plane, they were showing a film of Capricorn One with a great friend of mine called Brenda Vaccaro, and I'd done a play with her on Broadway. And when I got there, I'd stayed with her at the top of Benedict Canyon, and she said, are you going to see Orson Welles when you're here? And I said, well, I haven't seen him for five or six years. And she just said, he eats every day at Ma Maison, which was a sort of chic restaurant at that time. Why don't you go? And I didn't know whether I should go. By that time, he'd left his wife, Paola. He was living with a Croatian would-be actress, sculptress, whatever. And I didn't know whether he would want to see me, because his life had changed. So I debated whether I should ring up and book a table, and then the maitre d' would be bound to say, oh, Keith Max. But I didn't. And then on the morning I thought, well, I'll go. And Brenda lent me a car, and I drove to Ma Maison, and I was late, and I parked the car, and as I did, and I really was so nervous, Orson was coming down the steps with a waiter on each side. And he'd always been big, but he wore a lot of padding for Falstaff. Now he was gargantuan, and he had to be helped down the steps, and a taxi driver was waiting for him. I didn't have the courage. I sort of was sheltering under this bougainvillea to step forward and say, hello, it's... And... He got into the car and drove away. That's the last time I saw. And then I did realize that tears were streaming down my face. But I never saw him again. No. But I see him in this film.
And as we... Hasn't this been a fabulous evening? Keith Baxter, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.